Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, Brain Hackers. Dave Farrow here with another Brains Behind It. I'm talking to Renee Jones. She's a counselor. She is a healer. She talks about food. And I know I talk a lot about food on this show. We've had a bunch of people doing tech startups with food. Well, this is kind of on the other side of the coin, which is essentially something that I'm really passionate about. And I was working on a book on this. And then I find her book, What's Really Eating You? Overcoming the Triggers of Comfort Eating. And, you know, in my head, I'm thinking that's very similar to the brain hacks for dieting. And I wanted to talk to her and I wanted to find out more. So we're going to have her on the show after this. Hey, Renee, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing really good. So so you are a counselor. You actually do several things, but your book is pretty popular. It's Overcoming Comfort Eating Triggers. Anybody who's ever struggled with their weight or just anybody has a problem with that. What success have you seen with this book? And what do you think is the most important thing to take from it?
Well, I think the success comes from the fact that all diets will work. It's just sticking to them. And the number one thing that sabotages a diet is comfort eating or emotional eating or stress eating. So, I mean, I was on a diet for 40 years because I was yo-yoing up and down and not able to stick to it. So once I managed my emotional eating, it freed me from the diet.
And so you talk about your experiences in the book, but this is also based on a lot of evidence. There's a lot of studies out there on behavioral neuroscience, and it even gets into things like economics theory and things like that about how people eat, right?
Yeah. Well, and Harvard released a study back in like February where they found that they had all these people on different diets, and when it came down to the end, it didn't seem to matter whether you were low fat or high fat. Mm. The deal was emotional eating. So yeah, there's all kinds of mental stuff that goes into what we put in our mouths.
Yeah, and in fact, it's fascinating. You don't see a lot of that. Everybody who's talking about diet and exercise, they're either like really ripped and they're into exercise, or I guess you could go back to the whole, fad craze and all the infomercials. You can go back to all sorts of dieting gurus and things like that, where sometimes they got into kind of the emotional side of it, but they didn't really have any solutions. It was more just oh, that sucks. Try eating this instead or something. So would you say, like, I'm a big fan of strategies. The strategy of drinking a glass of water if you feel a craving, like just drink a glass of water first, wait 10 minutes or something, or getting used to waiting. That was one that I used. I had one that worked really well for me. I had a problem overeating, and I wasn't an emotional thing, but it was more of a habit of snacking. Mm-hmm. And my stomach was full. It was actually full and bursting, almost painful, but I still felt, I guess, I eventually realized it was a habitual reaction. It wasn't a craving, but it was a habitual reaction to just where I was at the time, the fact that I was in front of the TV, that sort of thing. And I was eating, and I realized I was physically hurting myself. It hurt. My stomach was getting so stretched already. I was still eating chips, but it wasn't emotional for me. I wasn't, sad. I was actually feeling pretty good. But would that be into the same category at all? Good, like the habitual things?
Yes, because our habits are there because they work for us. Mm. I mean, one of the strategies I give people is if you want to eat something, whatever it is, lay the table, put it on a plate, use a knife and fork, spoon, whatever it is, and sit down at the table and eat it. If you really want that ice cream while you're watching your late night TV,
right?
It's not about the food. It's about the habit or about some emotional connection you have to it. This is how I end my day. This is how I feel good. This is how I relax. But if you take out the TV, you're more likely to focus on the food and actually enjoy it.
And also, this is the I've had a tough day, so I deserve this, and all that sort of stuff. Your brain plays all these little tricks. So that's actually an interesting strategy, because breaking habits, breaking your pattern, is the number one thing. It's super important. So you're basically saying to people, yeah, you can eat your bad food, just do it differently each time, you know, and you can still have your cake and eat it too. You just can't have your TV on in the background, or your Netflix, or your, you know, scrolling through Facebook, stressing out while you're doing it. Like, so focus on it. And what's the theory behind that? If you focus on, pay attention to it more, you'll enjoy it more. You don't need as much.
Because we eat so mindlessly often, we get finished. We've eaten it all very quickly. And it's like, well, I didn't enjoy that. Mm-hmm. I need another one. In fact, I remember years ago, Oprah was in France and she bought two croissants because she knew she would eat the first one quickly, and she bought the second one to enjoy it. And I thought, if you just enjoyed the first one, then that might have eliminated the need for the second one.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that before. And I've also, you know, another big, I guess, brain hack also is to eat slower. People have done everything from counting their bites to I put together a plan called a breath between bites, where I found that people were just not breathing, and whenever I was in an emotional state and I was snacking too much, I'd have, you know, one chip and I would have a full breath and then have another, and that even like that sounds almost absurdly, you know, that you need to do that. But it was literally, you know, is still eating so fast and choking and everything. So, like a breath between bites, breathbetweenbites.com, I got that URL, is kind of like, you know, a big brain hack that kind of started me down this road. Name a few more, you know, tricks and suggestions that people can have if they're struggling.
Well, one of the things that I do is I teach this acronym, HANG, getting the hang of it, right? So the H is hungry. Ask yourself, am I hungry? And if you're hungry, go eat. If you're not, then think about, okay, so what's the A? What's the attraction to food in that? And just analyze that. And
why do I want this? If I'm not hungry, why do I want this right now?
Exactly. Okay. And then, what is it that you actually need? Is it, do you need a hug? Do you need a walk? Do you need to play with the dog for 5 minutes? Do you need some interaction with a friend? I mean,
in other words, are you looking to feel better? Or just entertainment, you know? It's entertaining. Yeah.
And then the G is go. Go get that. Because if you get what you need, then you may not need that food snack right now. I mean, that's really brilliant. Have it. If you don't, well, do what you actually need.
That's a really great perspective. Yeah. What do you think about some of the things that I was looking into that have worked for me are things like intermittent fasting. I noticed an interesting hack based around addiction is that the number one most successful strategy for addiction is just to stop doing it. Cold turkey is the one in study after study. It's absolutely fascinating. There's all sorts of attempts. You know, people want to talk about the nicotine patch and all these sorts of things, but the fact is that cold turkey has the highest success rate of any addiction. So if you think of it that in food terms, that would be fasting. So I now fast in the mornings. I usually start eating around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and never felt better in my life. It's been fantastic. In fact, the cravings start to go down. It did take some time. Like I'm about a year and 6 months into it and not a problem now, but I'd say even within that first whole year, there were times where it was tough. Certainly the first 3 months were very tough. And I know that a lot of people have shorter time spans, you know, if they don't see results within 2 weeks, they get upset, but it takes longer for your body to adjust. Tell me about fasting and, or, you know, adjusting to these new habits.
Well, I would ask you, 2 years ago, did you think that would be a possibility for you?
No, absolutely. Actually, I used to fast from time to time when I was younger. I practiced Buddhism, so I was meditating and fasting from time to time. I just didn't know that it was good for me.
Yeah.
You know, well, there was all that. But there was all that data was saying, oh, you're going into starvation mode, and a lot of misinformation out there and everything that, you know, now we know conclusively that fasting is good for the human body. In fact, cleansing out all the sugars is a good thing, if done within reason. And obviously, if you're, you know, healthy enough, you know, people with diabetics or people with insulin issues, obviously it's a totally different world. And there's some, you know, conditions that they should think twice about it. But I think for the majority of people, they should try fasting at some point in their life.
Well, and I think one of the important things is the word try, because you know, I do some of that myself. I lost my weight on a different diet than I now am on, because that left me hungry and angry all the time. So I think sometimes we just have to try something, see how it works for us. But you've got to know why you're doing it. If you don't know why, you're less likely to stick to it. But yeah, I mean, I think intermittent fasting can do some wonderful things for you, but start out with, you know, not eating until 8 o'clock.
Then the first thing was cutting out the midnight snack. That's how bad I was. It was cutting out the midnight. It was actually like stopping eating at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and do not eat anything until 9 in the morning. That was the first challenge that I had to work on. And then I went, you know, then I skipped, you know, breakfast and you know, only started eating around, you know, noon or something. That was the next, like, there's plateaus. But, you know, my wife and I were on a similar journey. I had about like 40 pounds overweight. I was 240 pounds. And I'm actually quite comfortable. My ideal weight is around 195, 200. I've got a lot of muscle mass, so I can kind of hide it. I think a lot of guys do that. But I can weigh like an extra 40 pounds and it wouldn't be as noticeable. But I saw myself on Superhuman, on the show, but that filmed about 2 years ago. And I was like, whoa, I was a lot more overweight than I was ever before. But I could see it. Other people looked at it like I was wearing a suit. Like, you can hide these things pretty well. But I was.
You could see it.
Yeah. I mean, I went from, I'm a 35 inch waist, depending on the vanity sizing today, but 35 inches by the tape measure today. At that time I was 45. It was crazy. So a huge difference. But fasting really helped for me. I drink in the morning. I have a bottle of tea, and even though this says Arizona, I reuse the glass bottles. Actually have green tea in there, and I have usually a bottle of coffee, which maybe that much coffee might not be too good for me, but it works for me. I don't feel hungry until, you know, like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. My wife went a completely different path. She's at home with the child. She's around food all the time. Here I can be at work and distract myself so I can abstain. Right. And then eat, and then eat at night. She totally mastered portion control, and she had a lot of weight after the child, and she just trimmed down to like almost nothing. She's like disappearing. She's like under 100 pounds now, and just super energetic. She has a lot more muscle mass. She's doing like pull-ups and push-ups and doing like you know, fit activities and stuff, which she never was into that before. But portion control really worked for her. And I know so many people struggled with that. Is it just a matter of like trying so many different things and finding out what works, or is it a gender thing? Because I know fasting is very much a guy thing, you know, these days.
There are plenty of women who do the intermittent fasting as well. Okay. But I think the essential thing for every person is to figure out what works for you. After 40 years on a diet, I had tried them all, and I learned how to cheat on them all too. But when I finally found the one that worked for me, kept me satisfied, kept me feeling good, it made all the difference. It's not a diet now, it's a nutrition plan. And I think, you know, sometimes what worked for your auntie or your best friend or what the latest fad is immaterial. You've got to find what actually works for you. And I think, you know, our restaurant portions are crazy. The size of a portion of protein is about the size of your palm. Yeah. And that on a plate, you would say, that's not enough. If you were in a restaurant and really small portions there.
Yeah, no, this is, again, American portion sizes. I'm from Canada, and it's even different, even just across that border. You know, Canada and America are so similar. But, yeah, portion sizes are starting to get out of control in Canada, too. But they used to not be as influenced by that. And, of course, you go to Europe, totally different story. Japan, completely different story, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So, that's fascinating. Yes, it is important to find what works for your body, and it may be different for everyone. So sometimes you just have to practice, try some things out, give it a month, see how it goes. When you are feeling good, that's your diet.
That's great. So I gave you a little bit of background here, but I want you to do more talking. How you have a thing with the hand where you look at how much protein you need. My wife always said that, like, if you look at your fist, that's about as how big your stomach is. So that's how much you should be eating in one meal. Is there any other tricks like that that you can tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally, what is it? The baseball is the size of the starch if you do starchy foods.
Oh, okay. But it depends on the person, right? I mean, I have a bigger stomach than some smaller, perhaps, right?
Well, there is that. I think men get more than women do, just because, I mean, I think one of the things that I learned along the way is I'm only 5'3".
Right.
I have a medium-sized frame. I just can't eat 3,000 calories a day. It doesn't go well for me. This body can only burn so much. So find what your measurements are. And, you know, you can do the visual things of the baseballs and the cups or the dice for like cheese, dice.
Four dice, yeah.
But it's different for a woman than it will be for a man. And if you burn more calories, guess what? You get more.
So tell us what's the difference, biggest difference between men and women that you would suggest when it comes to, like, you know, triggers of comfort eating, the psychological side of it.
One of the things that I find with men is the ice cream at night thing.
Yeah, that was a big thing for me. Yeah, why is that?
It is. My theory is that it has to do with how your family did comfort. And very often when you're as a child, if you've won a game or lost a game or something happened, they say, do you want to go get some ice cream? So we associate ice cream with getting to feel better. And that's a huge thing for men. I haven't seen it as much for women.
Do you think it might be a physiological thing? Like, you know, ice cream is high in fat, and that's where you like kind of store fat. You do that at night, you know, kind of when all the predators are gone or something. There might be like an evolutionary thing there.
It's quite possible that, and you put fat and sugar, and you may as well just stick it on my hips.
You know, what about bread? I find this might just be my observation, but I know several women in my life that are just seem to be addicted to bread, whereas I don't see that with guys as much. Is there a gender thing there?
You know, I don't really know.
Bread,
I mean,
and pasta.
I know women do a lot of things, but the key is you eat something pleasurable, you get dopamine, and you feel better.
So it depends on what your background is too, and everything as well. Yeah,
I think so. I mean, mine was peanut butter.
Really?
Yes. I was completely addicted to peanut butter. But what I finally figured out was, oh, you know what? My grandmother loved peanut butter. We bonded over that. And when she was no longer with us, I found that connection in the jar. And it wasn't so much just the peanut butter. It was connected to the encouragement that my nan gave me.
Oh,
so
wow.
When I wanted to feel close to her, I would go get peanut butter.
That's so brilliant.
I think it is so much about what's in your background, what is driving you to food. Because when you crash land in front of the refrigerator and pull up a chair, that's usually not about actual food. There's something else driving you.
You just blew my mind. You know, I always had a thing for bacon, which shouldn't surprise people because people love bacon. But I was vegetarian for well over 15 years, and I still craved bacon. I love the smell of it. and I had like salty substitutes, right? Mm. But now I'm realizing that we always cook bacon first thing in the morning at the cottage, and that was our family cottage. It's the most beautiful place on earth in Biscotasy Lake. You can check it out if you like. It looks absolutely fantastic. Wow, yeah, kind of just blew my mind, you know? I'm going to go have some bacon now.
There's always a connection. And once mm-hmm. you figure out what is that connection, then you can manage it.
Mm. So how would you manage it? Is it a matter of like you get to have your treat, but you have certain rules in place? Do you use like a rule-based system? Like that's what a lot of people think of is this diet has rules and I'm cheating if I break the rules. What's your suggestion?
You know, I stopped buying peanut butter for a while just so I could get a handle on it. And what I found out is that, you know, there are places where they have these jars and they hold it for me and they keep it fresh. They even call it a store. So if you need it, you can always go get it. But that puts one layer between you and that trigger food.
So you don't get the big economy size. You'll get one little thing. When you're out of it, you just procrastinate buying a new one and say, you know what, I don't really need it yet, and it's over there. So scarcity. So you can't get into that scarcity mindset. How much do you think that scarcity mindset plays a role? That, I have to eat this because I'm going to run out.
If I tell you you can never have that again, what are you going to do? You're going to want to have it all the time.
Yeah.
So knowing it's there, it's available to you. You can go get it when you really want it, but you might want to think about, do I really want this? Or what is it that I need? Do I need to look at pictures of my grandmother? Do I need to just do a little grieving around that?
Do I need to get a different ritual? I know somebody every day on the way home from work, they pass by a store, they get a chocolate bar and they eat the chocolate bar on the way home, and they just need a different ritual, you know, and it's listening to the radio or something else that replaces that.
But find what works for you. I think that's my next book is find what works for you.
You do you. That's your book title. But how do you handle it when you've got these like enormous cravings? Like in the beginning, I've got a lot of self-discipline, and I'm not putting anyone down that doesn't, you know, that I'm not saying that people, you know, who are overweight don't have self-discipline, but I do know that that's one of my traits that I, you know, when it comes to all or nothing things, you know, fasting, mm-hmm. like for my Guinness record, I had to do kind of an all or nothing focused attempt. And I do know that I struggle in other areas, like, you know, portion control would be a really big struggle for me, but mm-hmm. fasting is easier for me. So, mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, even with that, I had moments where I would drive by Wendy's every night on the way home from work. And the craving for a Frosty was just so intense. Mm. And today, I just don't crave it. I actually tried to have a junior Frosty because I had a coupon, and I basically could eat half of it, and I couldn't handle the whole thing. It was too sweet, you know, like your palate changes. But what do you do in those early stages? Because, like, I think a lot of people hear that second part, that I don't crave the Frosty anymore, and they're like, oh, BS, right? Because they've never actually purged enough sugar from their system. They've never gotten it out of the system to get rid of the addiction and actually have a healthy relationship with it. So what do you do when you're in that incredibly craving state of mind?
I made a rule for myself because I used to be quite the sugaraholic. Mm-hmm. I needed sugar every day several times.
Yep.
And what I finally realized was this is not going to change until I do something different. So I made a rule. I only have sugar on Sundays. It still gave me the opportunity to have it, but it wasn't every day.
Then you need sugar, like any sugar, like even sugar in your coffee, or you mean like a sweet, like a dessert?
I mean, any sugar, processed sugar.
That's pretty hardcore. I have a little sugar in my coffee. You know, I don't know if I would be able to stick to that, but that's intense. That's impressive.
Well, I drink tea and I don't put sugar in my tea. Mm-hmm. So that helps because you reduce the amount, because I used to have sugar in my tea, but I reduced the amount slowly so that now I don't have sugar in my tea. That takes some of the sweet out. But I'll tell you, There was one Wednesday in there where I was in the pantry staring down the chocolate chips saying, I only have sugar on Sundays.
Well, what, I mean, what about a suggestion for a normal person? Could you do something like maybe sugar every other day?
Sure.
You know, like today's not. Yeah, because I think that delayed gratification is one of the biggest principles of success. Mm. You know, whether it's everything, you know, investing in a business, getting good grades in school, working out, everything, it's delayed gratification, right? Mm. So, mm-hmm. if I could delay that gratification for a day, yeah, I could see that. I don't know if I could wait till Sunday. But I could do every other day, maybe, and then yeah. then you're eating half the sugar you normally eat, right? Maybe a little bit more because you binge a bit on the other days, but still, overall.
Yeah. Well, and when I was taking sugar out of my tea, I took one cup a day that didn't have sugar in it for three or four days, and then I cut two of them, and then I cut three of them. And finally, I think I spent a month with my last cup of tea of the day having sugar in it. And then it was like, okay, this doesn't taste right anymore. And your palate adjusts to that. Just like the Frosty is too sweet for you now.
Yeah.
I found there are so many things that taste sweet. I didn't know almonds were sweet. Did you know almonds are sweet?
Yeah.
It was like, oh, wow. You begin to taste things again. So your palate gets...
You also become very picky with things that you didn't before, like water. Oh, my God. I can't just drink some water. It tastes too bitter or it tastes like soap or something. Somebody else drinks it. They can't tell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, spicy foods, you can do the opposite, where you can build up a bit of a tolerance and you can get more flavoring. I've got one thing in my diet book. I hadn't read yours, so I don't know. I hope I don't, you know... hope I don't cross swords at all, but I'll definitely, you know, if I knowingly use any of your tips, I'll definitely give you a reference or something or talk to you about it. But I had one thing that is kind of a theory of mine, that you flavor things because flavoring is that neurological response, right? It's not, it texture plays a role. Crunch plays a role. Crunch is an evolutionary result of fresh food. So like the crunch that you get in an apple, that's how your brain knows that that is a good apple to eat. If it's soggy, then it's not fresh. And that's so that the reason why we crave crunch is because it's a way for our ancestors to tell which food is good and which food is bad. Now, we've taken it to an extreme by deep frying stuff and creating crispy coatings. Nature doesn't have crispy coatings on things, but we've taken to extreme for everything. And that's why we crave these things so much, because our bodies really are not adapted for that level of it. So for the same thing with flavor, you can flavor things with fats. So butter, things like that, and also the ice cream and creams and stuff. You can also flavor things with spices, you know, even something like salt and pepper is still a spice, but then you get into turmeric and garlic and curry and chili powder and things like that. So I've got a theory. I'd actually really love to do a study on this to find out that there's certain people who really, really like spicy food. Mm. And I wonder if, as a result, they end up eating less fatty foods, because the more spice you have, the less fat that you need. Fat is a flavoring because it sticks the flavor to your taste buds. That's why when you eat something really creamy, it'll stay there for a while and go, I can taste that, right? Whereas spices don't do that, but they're much more intense on whatever scale they are, whether it's heat or whatever flavor. And I wonder if there's a correlation there, that the spicier you make your food, the less fat you crave with it.
Hmm. Entirely possible. I know that when you add spices, you know, whether it's cinnamon or hot curry of some sort, it does give you a different experience of it. Of course, my body actually needs a little more fat than the average person. So maybe that's why I don't eat as much in terms of spice.
Okay, so you're not a spicy person either, no?
No, okay. Not really. In fact, I used to work for a magazine called Chili Pepper, Yeah. And they said, if you can't down a jalapeno, you'll never be part of the team. And I was like, I will never be part of the team. I just can't do it.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be hot spices, but you could like, you know, different flavorings and everything. But it was kind of like, it seemed like there was those two areas. Okay. So what about things like that? Like individual palate distinctions, different cultures have different, you know, diets. How do you tackle that with kind of a one size fits all approach? Where I know you're not a one size fits all, but you know, you have certain experiences. We all have certain limitations and different people come from different backgrounds and also different areas have different access to different foods as well. Food oasis and things like that. How do you handle those cultural issues?
Well, I had a client in India and one in New Zealand at about the same time. And they very different palates. But what we did was we worked within their culture because they've got to be able to get the food, right? So if
India has one of the highest rates of heart disease, I found out, right? Yeah. And well, it was just really surprising because it's also one of the highest rates of vegetarians. So that was one of the ways that people debunked the meat associated to heart disease type thing. But yeah, there's a lot of diet related health problems in India now that they're getting more industrial.
They're getting more like us.
And they're getting the standard American diet. Sad. What about food oases? You know, in North America, you have a lot of places, usually urban centers, where there used to be a corner grocer, and now there isn't. The economics just doesn't support them anymore. And you've got these big box grocery stores, but they tend to be more in suburban areas, you know, and it also tends to be appealing more to people who can drive a long way. Now, a lot of people have made this into a social justice thing, but it's actually just, you can just see the economics of it. Some of these, fresh fruits and vegetables, it's very tough to cart that into a city. So there's areas where you can't get a tomato. What do you do in situations like that? And how can we change that?
Could be the social justice thing. I'm not sure, but
it's starting to change. People are saying that, and you know, sometimes, you know, if the economics don't provide it, then, you know, sometimes local community gardens are popping up and people are trying to make a difference, but it's just that I think it's how food has changed since the coming of the refrigerator. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, the refrigeration as it is today really only became big in the 70s. It's really not that long ago. I'm getting a little internet instability here. Okay, we're back. All right. So in other words, before refrigeration, you had an ice box, and that's when the person of the house, you know, usually the woman of the house, would have to go out almost every day to get fresh ingredients for their food. So that's where we get, you know, I still see this in Toronto, kind of remnants of this, where there's the corner grocer, you know, where you go to this corner store, and what we would now think of as a 7-Eleven, but it's like half vegetables, half fruits and vegetables. Yeah. Those used to be everywhere there was people. It used to be that you had to walk to that corner store because walking was the key, not driving and everything. Now with refrigeration, we can hold on to foods longer, so we don't need to go every day. So these smaller grocers shut down time and time again, especially in the urban areas. But what happened economically is because of the big box store movement, they can buy in huge bulk numbers. So I drive my SUV soccer mom, you know, with the kids over to the grocery store and I can get all the fresh fruits and vegetables I want. But what people didn't realize is that there's some of these urban areas where people, you know, don't have a car, you know, they're using the bus, they're in limited income, and it is incredibly expensive to get what is a very cheap source of food, like vegetables. You know, what I mean is like a broccoli is like less than a dollar, you know, it's less than a bag of chips, but it's so much healthier for you. But having to get on a bus and travel to there, and then, you know, that's time that you could be working, you know, so that's the economics of it. When you work with people, have you worked with some of those issues, I guess food justice they call it or something like that, in some of your work with dieting?
Not too much. Most people are not in that urban environment. Texas is pretty spread out.
Okay.
But one of the things that I can think of is buying frozen. Because at least they freeze it at the peak of freshness. So it's going to be a little better than, you know, going to the local fast food place and getting fries with whatever else you're getting. But, you know, I think.
But it's tough to make frozen. Best. It's tough to make frozen stuff taste good, though. That's when you've got a. Well, the other side of the coin is that people don't cook at home either, right? So they tend to they tend to order out and eat out. So what do you say to somebody who, you know, was not taught how to cook? I had to learn how to cook. You know, you know, doesn't cook from scratch, and at the same time. You know, has to use frozen vegetables, which honestly don't taste as good, right? Because they're frozen. And then, you know, they've got time constraints, you know, they've got to cook for a family and everything. And there's like, you know, half hour to do all this. You know, obviously, you know, challenges are challenges, but what would be like the top tips that you would give to that person that would make a difference, you think?
I think making the best choices you can, given the limitations. You know, most places will have a salad of some sort. Most places will have some vegetables on the menu. Now with people recognizing over the last decade or so that whole low fat thing kind of led us down a very poor path because we've only gotten heavier since that came out. You know, look at what's available. Don't just get the same thing every time. Evaluate it. Look at the calories. Look at the nutrients that are in it.
Do you think it's a good idea to have calories like make regulation to force all restaurants to show their calories on their menu? That's something that came into New York State recently.
I like seeing that. I don't know whether it was a really good idea, but I like being able to say, okay, so this is going to have this many calories. Now, how do I manage the rest of my day? Because in the end, again, I'm 5'3", this body only burns so many calories. How am I going to make the best choice? If it's Sunday and I'm going to have the chocolate cake and it's 500 calories,
you got to make some other decisions. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, make some different choices.
Well, what about suggestions for kids? You've got kids in the household; they're picky eaters. How do you try to raise them right and not instill some of these comfort eating triggers in the first place, but you know, you still want to make them feel good and happy while they're eating, you know?
I think, you know, when I was growing up, I apparently was my mother said, you ate like a bird, a little bit all day long. I didn't start putting on weight until I got into school and I had to eat at certain times. And I know that we worry about, you know, the clean plate club. We worry about them getting enough nutrients for this time period. And I think if we let them eat as much as they want at that moment, before we've started putting all this diet stuff on them, you know, just my plate and plastic wrap were best friends. If I didn't finish it went in the refrigerator and I could have it later.
Leftovers, so
I think children have an innate sense of how much food they need. And when we're trying to, you know, put them on our schedule, it alters their intuitive eating pattern. And it sets us up for gaining weight. You've got to eat all of this right now.
Yeah, it's tough because sometimes, like, because you know that you want to get your children to eat, but they, you know, they sometimes resist you on it, and you don't know whether you should push or not. You know, for Lex, my son, what we've done is we taught him the difference between healthy food and fun food. You know, and healthy food is going to make him big and strong, and fun food is just for entertainment. So you have a little bit of it, right? And, you know, we always can make these deals where, like, you know, if you finish that, then you can have like one little chocolate egg from your Easter thing or something like that. And, you know, making these deals like that, it kind of shows, I think it shows instinctively that treats should be the minority of your diet and healthy treats food should be the majority.
Treats should be treats, not the main course.
Right. All right. Well, I mean, this has been fascinating. Tell people how to get a hold of you. You have a great website name.
Yes, it's packyourownbag.com.
All right. And pack your own bag. What's the idea behind that?
Well, I think our baggage sort of gets packed for us. And we continue to work from that baggage until we say, hey, I didn't mean to go here, or I really don't want to live that way. We unpack some things and then pack for the journey you want to be on. What do you need to take you on your own journey, not the one that you stumbled into or were told to?
That makes sense. It makes total sense. Well, thank you very much, Renee, for being on the show. You're definitely a brains behind it. And I even learned a few little hacks and tricks as well.
Good. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.